From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. If you know the names Anthony Bourdain or Mario Batali, certainly you have been touched by the influence of my guest today, Jeremiah Tower, whose his book Manners, by the way, which came out, I guess, last year, was one of the most fun books I've ever had the pleasure of reading about etiquette. His new book, of course, is Jeremiah's Start the Fire, but his book California Dish actually touches on a lot of the stuff that's in that, and he's the central figure in the terrific documentary The Last Magnificent. Jeremiah Tower, thanks for being here so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
And
before you go any further, I have to say that all my publicists are so impressed that you invited me on the show. So you're a local hero. So an honor to meet you.
A loco hero. There's like a misunderstanding. They didn't get it quite right. But when I saw the title, Start the Fire, I actually thought of that first chapter in California Dish, Taming the Fire.
Right.
Where you basically talk about what you said was your first public appearance.
Right, absolutely. In Newport at the Astor Mansion when we were supposed to do, we did the lunch, but it was supposed to be out of the kitchen. And the French crew there, the young chefs, French chefs, said, you know, wait a minute, excuse me, you're just California kids. We're the important French. Get out of the kitchen. So we had to cook everything on charcoal, including the dessert.
Talk about that dessert that you thought you were going to do in the oven that you end up doing on the grill.
Yeah. I mean, it was a mixed berry compote with sugar syrup, and we're going to heat that up and pour it over ice cream. So I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to show the French. So we had lined up these grills in front of the 100 journalists outside.
We say this was like an event that Ocean Spray put on to help promote
cranberries. Right. Well, I used cranberries on the lamb as a marinade, and that worked pretty well, but otherwise I didn't bother with cranberries.
It was also a big event to help sort of showcase Guy Savoy. Right?
Yes, yes. It was all about, you know, the new cuisine that was so popular and famous without cream or butter. Of course, he used a lot of cream or butter, but nobody noticed. So I lined up my chefs. I put on my red sunglasses, and we—
Your brand-new red Ray-Bans.
Ray-Bans, which I bought for the occasion, you know, for the photography. And then each person had a great big sauté pan, and there were four of us. We lined up and in unison tossed the berries over the charcoal. And I have to say, I mean, it impressed the hell out of them and impressed the hell out of me as well.
Well, it's so great because I first of all, the reason I brought that up is that that's where you mentioned that you— but inadvertently coined the phrase, the new American cuisine, which is something that has stuck with that cuisine ever since. But there's a line in that chapter of the book that stuck with me, even as I was watching the film The Last Magnificent, where you say that you were aware that you were about to get everything you wanted, and you didn't know if you wanted it or not. And so much, it seems in some way that line has kind of framed a lot of your life, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It was that, you know, be careful what you wish for. But, you know, all of the whatever press or fame I had achieved at Chez Panisse and the couple of years afterwards, that was to fill the restaurants. You know, I mean, it was, you know, be famous. People will come and see you and sit down and have dinner and you can finally make some money. That day, I realized that we had gone something else, you know, that instead of just watching the, I call it, you know, courting the press, I call riding the tiger, and you always have to be careful. It'll reach around and bite you sooner or later. Well, that time I realized I was firmly in the saddle on the back of the tiger. And on the plane ride back to San Francisco, I was, you know, I couldn't stop crying. I realized that everything had changed. And I either had to run, go to the beach, or, you know, get on with it.
But I guess, again, I found myself thinking about that chapter when I was watching the film, just because in reading so many of the books of yours I've read, that sort of sense of an ambition to enjoy what's in front of you but constantly looking ahead has been these two poles that have informed your life.
That's very true. I mean, that's amazingly insightful because there were always two Jeremiah. Well, after that moment in the plane at the Astor Mansion, you know, and we got out of 100 newspapers across the United States, we got the cover of the food section in living color. You know, it said, mesquite is it, you know. And then that was when they coined the phrase New American Cuisine. And I just realized after that there would have to be two Jeremiah Towers, one the sort of the public figure and then one the private, because I realized seeing all those articles that if I read all the publicity, you know, my head would explode. I would believe my own press, which is always a disaster. So after that, I read them all and then decided I'm never going to read another review again unless it's a bad one. And then I'll talk about it with staff.
Well, I just find it so interesting because in that event, you basically set the tone for what became Stars.
Right.
Interestingly, it's almost as if that was kind of the building block, the idea of making sure that people saw what you were doing, that you could make a show of it, but also show your apparent ease at the same time. All those things that became what you would do at Stars, which I've unfortunately never got a chance to go to, it seems that that set the foundation for it in that one event in some weird way.
Yes, I realize the power of improvisation, you know, and chance and chaos in your life. You know, you grab it and make something fantastic out of it. And there's something about that energy and the, you know, harnessing chaos of the moment that really does capture people's imagination. And I also realized in the power of the press, and I thought, that's when I realized I'd changed. You know, if I accepted to continue that way, I could manipulate the public and the press and everything in order to fill the restaurants again.
Now, there's a phrase you use in both Start the Fire and in California Dish. You talked about writing to your grandmother from France and talking about, what was that? I'm trying to make sure I got it right. So many restaurants that taste of nothing but money.
Actually, that wasn't early. I was 16 when I wrote that thing. You know?
Yeah.
And when I read that, I don't know how I had all those letters from her. And I read it, you know, when I was writing California Dish. I sort of blushed. I thought, oh, my God, you nasty, precocious little. You know, but, you know, that's who I was. I mean, they'd sent me to Paris to get my education and eating by myself. So there I was, 16, running around Paris, going to the restaurants that they said. And I had to sort of send back reports. I wrote letters back to them.
But you also, too, I mean, you write in both the books about making that trip across several continents and what the food in each one of these stops did to you. And
right.
Just the sort of the extraordinary palate that children have. But also, you're really attuned to your nose in a way that I think the kids are not. I mean, scents were so important in all those portions.
Yes. I mean, it helped that I grew up, you know, first when I was, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 in Australia in a tropical setting, you know, in Sydney. So I had passion fruit vines outside my bedroom window. I could reach out the window and pick, you know, ripe passion fruits. There were bananas. There were.
You said you'd have passion fruit almost every day, wouldn't you?
Yes, absolutely. And still to this day, I lust after it, you know. But, I mean, you mentioned before pineapple juice. Well, ripe pineapple. I mean, the kind that, you know, you can cut off the top and dig in with your fingers and eat the whole thing. There's no core. I mean, that pineapple juice, as I first experienced it in Fiji. So then I, you know, a few years ago, I wrote 3 articles called Pineapple Love for the San Francisco Examiner. My first pineapple love, my second pineapple love. And the third one, which we definitely can't talk about.
Well, let's save it for later. But
okay.
But I think what's so I found so fascinating, I mentioned to you before we sat down that whenever I read you on pineapple juice, I drop what I'm doing. I go to try to find something that approximates what you're talking about.
Right.
But I know what you mean about I spent time in the South. My grandmother was from Mississippi. So I go and just remember the smells of the fruit that you just don't get because now,
right.
As you talked about in the book, when you guys moved to Australia, there really weren't refrigerators, so you had to eat everything. You had all these almost primal odors.
Right. Once that fruit is refrigerated, the perfume goes, you know, all those very subtle flavors go. But there's nothing quite like cutting a papaya off the tree in your garden, putting it in the icebox for 30 minutes, you know, so it drops from 100 degrees to, you know, to 85, and then eating it with your fingers.
Well, I just find so wonderful. By the way, it's the treatment, I guess, of Jeremiah Tower. He's the central figure in the terrific documentary, The Last Magnificent, is that you have such a, I think you have almost a journalist's eye for detail, but a sensualist flair for describing things that are not just mere detail. I mean, the way you describe that Dodge Dart that you Peter around San Francisco to go to these places that one of which you found you first went to as a child, the place where you found the seafood, right?
Yes, in Big Sur. It was the Garapata Trout Farm. And my father, my grandfather, who lived in Carmel, would take us down there. And, you know, you'd catch the trout and then grill them on the little fire next to the street, next to the ponds. And so when I, years later, 20 years later, at Chez Panisse, I decided to do Truiteau Bleu, blue trout. And, of course, that meant, you know, it's cooking everyone's trout to order, killing the trout and poaching it to order. I thought this was a terribly grand idea. So we trucked them up from Big Sur, from the same place I'd been as a kid. And then I had to kill each one and then poach it in champagne and then serve it up. Well, after the sixth one looked up and we went, and I went, okay, I said to the dishwasher, you come over here and start killing trout. I'm not doing that anymore.
But I just find just from all the reading that at what point were you kind of astonished that everything you'd done in the first 15 years of your life led you to this? Because as you mentioned, when you were first putting together this thing, the Astor event for Ocean Spray, that you were an untrained chef. So this is all your enthusiasms coming to intersect.
Right. I mean, it's about, I never meant to be a cook or a chef professional. My first day at Chez Panisse was the first day I'd ever cooked in a kitchen.
And that's a great story, by the way, when you're showing up there, just demanding the job because you had no money.
You're right. I was down to my last $25. And, you know, that's the role of chaos and chance in success, certainly in my life. And I really believe that those moments come along. Somebody last night, a young chef, young cook, asked me last night, well, you know, what do I do? I want to be this and I want to do that. I'm not quite sure. I said, stop thinking about it. Stop trying. You know, just be open. Take the first thing that comes along, you know, in whatever industry it is. If you have a passion for it, you'll do it. But it's sort of like, you know, you're going to go to a party and say, I'm going to meet, you know, my long-term life partner and lover tonight. You know, well, the more you look like that, of course, you scare everybody away. And I think one scares opportunities away unless you just relax about it. But, you know, there was a moment when I realized it was, I think, as it says in The Last Magnificent, there's a moment when I'm talking about Chez Panisse. And I suddenly realized that everything had gone before in my life had led me up to this.
I think what's interesting, too, is that, you know, Tony Bourdain in the film calls Tavern on the Green a chef killer.
Yes.
Just because it's that oddest thing. It's a place in New York of enormous size.
Right.
But it's really not a hospitable room in a very strange way.
I love the idea of doing it. It was a challenge, you know, and I just wanted to be able to cook. I didn't want to have to run a restaurant and do the HR and the administration and the insurance and God knows what. I'd, you know, done that for 35 years, so that was enough. But I thought I could go back into a kitchen and have fun and turn the kitchen around at least. But it is, and I love the fact it was in Central Park and its history and its glamour and everything.
And part of it too must have been for you scaling Mount Everest.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, why did you do it? Well, because I could. I looked up and saw the peak and thought, you know, I want to get there. But it is actually the design. I was talking to Lydia, the director of the film, last night about that. I said, you know, it took me a while to realize that the configuration that the owners did is sort of impossible. So even if I'd had complete control of the whole thing, I could never really have pulled off another Stars. I mean, the kitchen, that sort of, you know, $2 million kitchen or whatever it cost, was so badly designed, there was no place to heat up plates. Hello. Good God. That's, you know, even, that doesn't even get to Restaurant Design 101. That's...
We're going to take a break so I can get a little snack, maybe to have a little pasta water or something. My guest is Jeremiah Tower. He's a central figure in the terrific documentary, The Last Magnificent. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm what Baudelaire would call one of the potato eaters. My guest sitting across from me is Jeremiah Tower. He is author, bon vivant, the inventor of the restaurant tradition as we now know it. He's the star of the new documentary, The Last Magnificent. And it's obvious that you and Tony Bourdain become friends, because even his writing style brings you to mind as having two different ways of sort of finding the tale, both the kind of emotional detail and the way you feel about something, but right. also an eye for accuracy, because clearly that's very important to you.
Yes. As I say in the film, if you're doing something, there's no point doing it unless you do it as perfectly as you can possibly do it.
But I think of you almost in the way I think of him first and foremost as a writer, and your love of life, really. I mean, being vivacious in the true sense of the word.
Right.
And that's why I said bon vivant. That comes across. I mean, and what I said in the first half of the show about that kind of curiosity that I think is really stoked by a classic liberal arts education, those are all the things I think about when I think of you.
Well, they all came together in that moment when I first started cooking professionally. But Stars was when they all really, you know, came together in the terms of, you know, the hospitality and everything it involves. So it was a theater, you know, it was a performance theater every night. And so I would draw on my, you know, ability to know what kind of clothes to wear, to kiss the hands of all the divas and the socialites in San Francisco. I mean, the first time when I got there, I was trying to raise money. Somebody, a socialite, invited me for a lunch party to meet wealthy socialites who were interested in the restaurant business. And I sat down next to one, and this man turned to me and said, "So what do you do?" And I said, "I'm a cook." And he went, "Ew." I mean, he wanted to change places. A year later, after Stars opened, he would call me. You know, he wanted my private cell phone so that he could get a reservation, because he couldn't get one otherwise. And I thought, wow, how the world turns.
What's really fascinating, too, to see that footage of Stars and to see how you navigated the place. It's almost like you became a different person going from one section of the restaurant to another. And that really is kind of like taking on a role or being an actor in some way, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. I mean, when you shake hands with 350 people every day, if you don't look them in the eyes and make it seem you mean it, there's no point doing it. So that's acting. And that was the public Jeremiah Tower, who then would have to go to the bar at 6 o'clock and have, you know, chug a lug a glass of Krug and then go back to work, you know. So, you know, fueled by champagne is not a bad idea.
And as we know from your book, champagne, you drink it in effect, but we boil this down, only when you're thirsty.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that fabulous quote by Lily Bollinger, you know, which I can never, it's one of my favorites, but I can never remember the whole thing.
It's like, but several stories. And, yes. And it's funny, several stories. I guess the thing that struck me about Chez Panisse when I went is how small it was.
Yes.
It's a tiny
yes.
place.
Well, of course, in the beginning, you know, I would buy all the food at 6 o'clock in the morning, go around to Chinatown and San Francisco.
In that Dodge Dart.
In that Dodge Dart. It wouldn't go up hills, which was an interesting choice of car for San Francisco. So my big challenge of the day was how to get from point A to point B without involving hills, which is, you know, interesting in San Francisco. So then I'd go to Oakland, and then I'd rush in and cook lunch for, you know, 50 or 60 people all by myself. Then, you know, Willie Bishop, the great sort of coke-snorting beatnik drummer, would come in, and we would cook dinner for, you know, 60 to 100 people. And then we'd get up the next day and do it again. But we could only do that because, you know, those were the numbers. Then, I mean, the most dinners we ever did at Stars was 701. So there was a huge difference. That night I was working the door, and all the staff begged me, you know, please never do that again.
It's making me sweat just to hear about that. But I can tell you, I first started to visit San Francisco in the late 80s. And by that point, the food culture of that city has so been changed. And people told me it had gone from a place that basically you only go to North Beach to eat spaghetti, and that was kind of it.
Right.
North Beach and Chinatown, those are the places you went to eat.
Right.
To a city where there were restaurants everywhere, and there was all the influence of Chez Panisse.
Yes. For instance, take Zuni Cafe, which is still there and still wonderful, and, I mean, pretty much the same as it's been for 30 years. Judy, who bought it after the original owner, I mean, she had worked at Chez Panisse after I left. And so she brought that food culture of, you know, beautiful ingredients, all fresh, wonderful, as local as possible, just because that means they're the freshest you can get, cooked simply. In the philosophy that we had at Chez Panisse, which was, it's all about the ingredients. For me, a great chef finds the ingredients, buys them, stores them properly, because if you don't, you know, it doesn't matter how good they are, and then cooks them and presents them as simply as possible. I mean, the real rock stars here are the ingredients, not the chef. Of course, that's weird for me to say that, but I believe that.
Well, I'm glad you do, because no one else does. But
Not these days, anyway.
Well, it's funny you said that, because I just remember that great phrase, again, going back to California Dish. I'm sorry I keep doing this, but I'd like to help sell your books.
Right.
That we even see in the movie The Last Magnificent, that great phrase, that saying you're high on fatigue and adrenaline poisoning.
Right.
Which I just love, because that to me so describes what a kitchen is about,
yes,
finally.
Yes. I mean, the extraordinary thing is when I sold Stars to this Chinese group and took my sufficient money to Paris for the to the Georges Sank for a month.
Hope you didn't have room service there.
I thought, boy, this is going to be amazing. I can actually go out to dinner. But at the same time, I was still revved up, hooked on adrenaline, you know, and I realized that I had been very tired for 30 years. And now I wasn't. It was an amazing thing. And that's when I realized, you know, I couldn't go back to San Francisco and be, you know, the famous Jeremiah Tower sitting there having lunch for 4 hours a day at Zuni every day or whatever restaurant, because that would just be pathetic. So
why would that have been pathetic?
Oh, it's pathos in that. You know, so what is he doing now? I mean, as Anthony said, you know, if Salinger had written another book and hadn't been any good, I mean, how would people think of him now? Not that I can compare myself to that kind of talent, but I thought, what could I possibly do after Stars that would be even greater? So I thought, well, go to the beach, you know. Because I sat down and while I was in Paris, I wrote a list, you know, what is it that scares me the most? First of all, I said, what are all the things that you always wanted to do and never done? And one was scuba diving. And then I said, so what scares me the most? And at the top of the list were sharks, because of my growing up in Australia and horrible things happening. So I went, right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the, you know, warm tropical waters, learn to scuba dive, and then face sharks, which I did.
And you came out.
Oh, yes, yes. And I survived with all those teeth around me.
Because as you find when you're around sharks, and I've never done this, but I've spoken to people who have, they mostly don't care.
No, who knows that? You know, after you've seen Jaws, you know they care. But, of course, they don't.
One of the fascinating parts of the movie for me is that section where you get to read all the press that's coming in. And, right. and you're sort of like going back and forth between being that private Jeremiah who's not quite sure why these things are being said and the public Jeremiah who has to deal with these things knowing right. you're going to have to respond to them. Right. That to me is like watching these two men, these two different persona crashing into each other.
Yeah, crashing into each other. Well, as I said, you know, I never read the reviews if they were positive. Couldn't possibly. I knew my head would explode. I'd become, you know, I have a big ego anyway, but, you know, imagine pumping it up with all those wonderful things that people were saying about me or the restaurants. Impossible. Or possible, but you would believe your publicity and then you're screwed. So Lydia said, no, you have to, you know, read these on camera. So it was a very foreign thing for me to read the reviews.
So she directed you to read those on camera?
Yes. Yeah, it was her idea, yeah. Jeremiah, sit at the bar. I think that's good. The lighting's good, and it's a good setting. Here's the New York Post. Open it to page 4 and start reading. Okay, Lydia.
But some of this folds into...
great.
It's terrific. That's a real director at work, first of all. That tells you that. But also it folds into this thing that comes through so often in your writing, the stuff I've read, is that sense of unidentifiable inchoate terror that's always kind of lurking in the cooking situation, isn't
right.
there?
I mean, Jim Villis in the film says, you know, that Jeremiah's always, he knows the guillotine is there. But, you know, I have a fatal attraction for the slim chance, where I like to take everything to the edge. And even though the whole staff at Stars, they loved being taken to the edge, and they also hated it because it was a lot more work. But, you know, when I go to San Francisco now, 30 or 40 of the ex-Stars staff show up and take me to lunch and have drinks and all that sort of thing. So they look back on it. So many of them now have their own restaurants or general managers and Vegas.
So many of the people you actually work with now have gone off, fanned out all over
the country.
Yes.
And the most wonderful thing happened about 10 years after I sold Stars. They would email me all the time and say, okay, now I'm a general manager at a hotel in Vegas, and now I get it. You were such a call it stars. And now I am one. And you taught me to be a perfect soul. So I love that.
Well, as they say in the Old Testament, I became what I beheld.
There we go.
But it's interesting, I just find too, because I don't think I've ever seen a film that really, in the way that we see you negotiating the restaurant, negotiates. Not, you say two different Jeremiah times, but I think there's more than that. I mean, just because I think when you're away from everything, and I wanted to ask you what it's like to be away from everything, to be in a place like Mexico where there are no demands placed on you in the right way that they would be in a place like Paris, where at some point or another you run across somebody who knew who you were.
Right.
And want to ask you where they should go to eat and do all those kinds of things.
Yes.
But in Mexico, you're really a different person.
Yes, I was. I mean, it was purely a different person until the Vanity Fair article about me hit. And then I went into the local market to have my morning soft tacos of pig's feet, you know. And the waitress, who barely speaks Spanish, she's in pure Mayan, came over with a copy of Vanity Fair and said, "Would you sign this?" I nearly died. What? I came here to get away from Vanity, let alone Vanity Fair. And now a Mayan waitress is presenting me with a copy of the magazine for my autograph. I thought, okay, it's time to go. I have to get further into the jungle, you know, or further down the beach.
So I have to ask you, how did Tony persuade you into doing this documentary?
Well, I mean, Tony, he read A California Dish, and then, of course, he's published the new version of it. I mean, the almost completely new version.
It is. There's a few sections that are similar, but it's mostly, yeah. And again, it's where I can see why he would, because the writing is so good, Jeremiah.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. So he read it and thought, it said it pushed his justice button. You know, I think there was also something, there was a moment a few years ago someplace in public with Anthony Bourdain and Alice Waters. The moment I've heard, I wasn't there, he called her the Khmer Rouge of the culinary world. Well, hello. I mean, all that aside, I think, you know, then Tony might have had a problem with Alice. I'm not sure. But it was a little boost to get this film done. And then he showed it to Lydia Tenaglia, and she at ZBZ, who she does all his TV shows. And she thought, you know, what a good idea. And then my final comment is, if the Iranian government couldn't say no to Anthony Bourdain, how could I?
Probably a great note to end it on. My guest is the man who survived being in the kitchen with the Khmer Rouge, I guess. Jeremiah Tower, the terrific film is The Last Magnificent. The book is Start the Fire, although I also recommend Manners, so at least you can learn why you shouldn't wear perfume when you're having wine. Right. And, of course, the book, California Dish as well. It's been a thrill to have you here. Thank you so
My
much for
thrill.
Doing it.
Honestly, the best ever.
My guest clearly has a low threshold for thrills. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yori. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm going to go look for truffles. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.